Good afternoon, everyone. If I could just have your attention for a moment. Good afternoon. Hello, everybody. As everybody can see, this room is over full, and we are working on getting an overflow room for folks so that there'll be another room you can go to watch what we're doing here today, because I'm just guessing the fire marshal might have a little trouble with what we're doing here today. So, you know, not to mention we don't want to, you know, well, I won't say that, but anyway, thank you all for being here. We're excited to have you. It's really wonderful to have so much interest in what we do here at the legislature, but we will try to find another room if you'll just hang on for a moment. We do want to have everyone be able to have a seat. Okay, so we've been told that we have room 10 available for overflow seating. So if anybody is willing to go down to room 10, room 10 would be on the tunnel level. And it's a nice big room with nice theater seats. Let me just tell you, though, if you wanted to testify on something, if you're expecting to testify, don't go to the other room because you won't be able to get back quite quick enough. But if people could, you know, we'd really like to have people not standing in the back unless it's absolutely necessary. So if you can, if you don't have a seat, you can go down to room 10. That would be very helpful. Thank you. Yes, and thank you for that. You know what? If you have a seat next to you that is empty, please raise your hand. And so someone can come and sit, because there are seats in here. Thank you very much.
And Madam Chair, over here, just to be sure that folks know that there'll be people who need to testify and probably people from the agencies and others that need to be in this room. And so if we need to make some space, folks should let us know if they actually need to be in this room. And just a heads up. I saw one of our authors sitting on the floor, so I wanted to be sure that we were able to do that.
Yes, and yeah, and of course, as I said before, anyone who needs to testify should not leave, because it will be really hard to get back here in time to testify. But if you don't need to testify and you are here to watch, please consider going to room 10. All right, with that, I'm going to officially call the meeting to order. This is the Health and Human Services Finance Division. Welcome, everyone. With so many folks in the room, we are going to change up the order of our agenda a little bit, because I have a feeling that the some bills are of more interest to the majority of the folks here in the room than others, perhaps. So we are going to start, if Representative Cantrell is here, we're going to ask him to start first, and so we're going to take up House File 1805. So Representative Cantrell is going to move House File 1805 to be laid over for possible inclusion in the supplemental budget bill.
Yes, Madam Chair, that is my motion.
So let's see. Is there an amendment?
Yes, Madam Chair, there is.
Okay, let's just move the amendment so that we can get the bill in the shape in which you'd like to discuss it. So Representative Cantrell is moving the A1 amendment. And let's just vote on that one and get it on the bill. So any discussion to the A1 amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. The motion prevails. And Representative Cantrell, to your bill.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you for your time today. It's an honor to be able to present House File 1805, which, as amended, appropriates $7.5 million from the general fund of the Commissioner of DHS to provide emergency services grants to eligible organizations that provide essential services for unsheltered folks living in Minnesota. As we are now moving into one of our many seasons that are post-winter, I think it's appropriate to reflect on just how significant the danger is to unsheltered persons during the winter time in Minnesota. Last year, when I was presenting this bill, I think I talked about the family of five who had a 4 or 5 year old child who had to sleep in their vehicle in Burnsville under an overpass because of the lack of sufficient services in the South Metro, but really in the state as a whole. To imagine to me that in one of the most prosperous states in our country, to imagine living in one of the most prosperous countries in the world, that we have insofar been unable to, I think, focus on with great intent, alleviating in its entirety our unsheltered crisis, to me, I believe is something that desperately needs our attention, not only during the winter months, but year-round. Because if people don't have access to shelter, if they don't have access to housing, if they don't know how to get that first foot in the door, then it's really hard for them to eventually build personal prosperity, to get access to health care, and all these other kind of things that we all know are essential foundational blocks for personal and familial prosperity. So just kind of as a touching base on some of the statistics. The unsheltered population statewide in Minnesota has increased about 62% since 2015. And in the Twin Cities alone, it has increased about 136% over the last decade. This is, I think, one of the most imminent crises of our time, especially as we approach, you know, a precipice of a great public health concern. You know, ensuring that we are still providing for, supporting, and uplifting unsheltered folks in the state of Minnesota is a matter, I think, of human dignity. So with that, Madam Chair, members of the committee, I thank you so much for the opportunity to discuss this today, and I will turn to my testifier.
All right. Thank you. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you so much, Madam Chair and members, Representative Cantrell. For the record, I am Wendy Underwood, Vice President for Social Justice Advocacy and Engagement at Catholic Charities of St. Paul in Minneapolis. Over the last 2 years, we have experienced a 32% increase in clients seeking services. One in four of those clients is over the age, I apologize, one in five is over the age of 55. Many of you are familiar with our Dorothy Day campus, just blocks from here, where we serve over 1,000 people a day. When our emergency shelter on that campus opened in 2017, we served 280 people every night. 3 years later, we are at absolute max capacity at 356 shelter guests a night. We are truly on the front lines of the significant increases in homelessness. The Emergency Services Program is one of the only sources of public funds available to support our critical shelter programs. Last year, thanks to the support from Representative Cantrell and this committee, a one-time infusion of ESP dollars passed, and we were able to secure the last beds we needed at our shelter. Until then, our expanded capacity required people to stay on mats. I never say sleep. They're staying at that point. We also use the one-time funding for a temporary housing navigator to help with the increased amount of shelter guests. That position ends in June, while the number of people we serve is very unlikely to change. The second half of our campus, known as the Opportunity Center, is where meals are served, healthcare is provided, and case managers work with homeless clients to find housing and services. This site has also seen exponential growth, is recognized as a shelter program by the state, and is eligible for ESP, but there is no ESP available. Because of the lack of public resources, private funders and Catholic Charities reserves are doing its very best, funding 95% of this facility. Now, a site providing workforce services, access to health care, and three meals a day would seem like a public service, but it is not publicly funded. The rapid increase in people needing help calls for more resources we cannot fund. We are stretched to the max. Just like hospitals and nursing facilities, shelters must be seen as critical community infrastructure. We must be able to respond to emergency and complex situations, just like COVID-19. ESP helps us. It is the only flexible state funding to support shelter operations, ensuring the success, safety, and well-being of our homeless community and our staff. House File 1805 recognizes the statewide need for ESP and does so ongoing so that investments can be smart and long-lasting. Minnesota will not overcome its homeless crisis without increased public funding. I thank you for this opportunity and ask my other testifier.
All right, thank you very much for your testimony. We have Commissioner Cascaden on the list. Please come down. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Sheila Cascaden. I am an Olmsted County Commissioner, but I am not here today representing the Olmsted County Board or the Association of Minnesota Counties. I'm really here because of the work that I have been doing in our community around homelessness and housing overall. So I just want to be clear with the chair, especially, that we don't have a county position on this bill. I responded to the invitation from Catholic Charities to come and tell you the Rochester story about homelessness, because Catholic Charities has become a very big ally of our community as we've looked to dealing with our unsheltered homeless. So Rochester, home of the Mayo Clinic, 3 million visitors a year, 150,000 people, the community. And we thought we were doing really well with addressing the needs of unsheltered homeless. We had a number of services in place. We have the Dorothy Day Shelter. We have an interfaith hospitality network. We have some of our churches who offer meals on a regular basis. The Salvation Army offers kind of a day gatherings place. Our library is welcoming to people who are unsheltered homeless. But about a year ago, we suddenly had a different experience. Suddenly, we found people sleeping in our skyways, sleeping in the stairwells of the parking ramps. And that is not healthy for them, and that is not healthy for the community. And there was a lot of community concern about that. So we began a little over a year ago, saying, what can we learn? And we worked with the State Office of Homelessness Prevention, and we worked with Catholic Social Service, Catholic Charities. We worked with the Salvation Army. And we have engaged the Corporation for Supportive Housing to help us do a long-term plan. Our most immediate thing was, how would we have some sort of shelter ready for the winter of 2019 to 2020? And the county stepped up, and we made a facility available that the county owns and did $250,000 of remodeling to that facility this summer and fall. That was well after the allocation you made last year was already disbursed. Now we're looking at, what do we need for the long term? We believe that we need navigators who will work with those who are unsheltered in our community. We did a survey, a three-day survey last fall, and identified about 130 individuals who were unsheltered at that point. We've succeeded in getting about 48 of them into housing, because that is our goal. Learning from Catholic Charities, our goal is to make any unsheltered situation for people temporary, one time, and very brief. And so we've been working very hard to create housing alternatives, to put in place outreach staff. And yet, as we do that, as we look to the future, how are we going to have a year-round shelter? That's an open question for us. How are we going to finance the outreach staff that we need? And Catholic Charities of Winona, who came in and is operating that shelter that the county made available without charge, is spending about $25,000 a month to keep that shelter open from 9 p.m. to 7 a.m. And that's only started in December and will end at the end of April. So our story is, like many communities, we are sort of caught unaware. We thought we were doing okay, but the unsheltered homeless were pretty much invisible to us till they made themselves visible in our in our skyways until there were many more of them. So we're having conversations with our major medical providers. Do we need a medical respite kind of option? They have been there. They have helped fund Catholic Charities services. But how long and how much can we rely on philanthropy alone? And isn't this a public health, public concern for the state of Minnesota? And so I'm here today to say I think that due consideration to this request, Representative Cantrell's bill, I hope that you will take active consideration. I know you have tough budget targets, but we can't have people in the underpasses, in encampments, in the skyways, in unprotected situations. So how can we work together, the private sector, with donations, philanthropy, as Catholic Charities has stepped in, and what's the role of government? It's going to take all three sectors' engagement to really address the needs of our currently unsheltered homeless and to work actively to prevent homelessness.
All right. Well, thank you, Commissioner Castaneda. And I just should say that she's my county commissioner.
and vice versa, Madam Chair.
And I'm her legislator. Of course, that's how it works. So, yeah.
And Madam Chair,
Ms. Underwood.
Thank you. And just in conclusion, I want to recognize, if you can't tell, today is Homeless Day on the Hill, led by the Minnesota Coalition for the Homeless, of which we are a partner. And I just want to thank all of those who came today. There's 850 advocates, people living in homelessness, and residents of our programs who are here to advocate for this important work. So thanks, everyone here.
Well, thank you. And, thank you, everyone. And, so we're delighted to have you here today, as I mentioned. And, you know, you can see that you're making quite a presence here by the very fact that we don't have enough room for you in one room. So it is very, really impressive to see your advocacy, and it really does make a difference when people show up for something that they care about. We're going to go to member questions. Representative Moran.
I didn't know I was going to come so quickly. So I think on this bill you're asking for $7.5 million. Can you talk about why $7.5 million?
Ms. Underwood.
Sure. Thank you, Madam Chair, Representative Moran. I can say that a couple of things. In 2019, when nonprofits and communities applied for ESP, there was just shy of $16 million in requests, and at the time, only $800,000 a year allocated. Because of the one-time infusion of $3 million passed at the end of 2019, a few more projects were able to be supported, but just a regular snapshot, in March of 2019, the requested needs were at $16 million. That number, too, is also the position of Homes for All.
Representative Moran.
Thank you, Chair Liebling. So this is an issue that's like really, really important to me that I have worked on and believe in. And I was just looking through some of the documents that talks about the individuals, the unsheltered homeless, that has increased by 62%. The unsheltered population has increased by 136% in the Twin Cities, and Greater Minnesota by 32%. And it just goes on and on and on. And we know we have invested a lot of money in this over several sessions. And quite frankly, not enough to directly impact people's everyday lives for the unsheltered. And but this is having like a huge impact, not only individuals, but families. We have families who are living out in their cars. They are families. And the impact of that is that children are being removed from these families because they are homeless. That's a really big impact. And so, you know, as we look at the unsheltered and look at individuals, which all of this is important, but we find the families, the kids who are being removed from their homes are turning to youth who are homeless, so we have a very high youth homelessness, which one day, if we don't get this under control, will be adults who are homeless. And so we really need to go upstream and really do some really good really investment. I'm looking at this chart here that talks about the number of organizations over time that have been given dollars. And I would say we are nickel and diming these organizations that really they cannot have an impact. And so if we're going to really make this a crisis that it is, we want to do some real investment, you know, because a lot of times we're investing money in structural pieces and asking for affordable housing that is unaffordable. And, you know, I don't really know what's happening to that $500 million that we are investing when we could be touching, like, real people's lives and doing the work that that Catholic Charities and so many other people are doing. But we are in a crisis, and, you know, 7.5 is a gentle ask, but it needs to be so much more than that. And so I'm hoping that we have some folks around the table come forth that is a part of Coalition for Homelessness to really speak on the behalf of all the families that we are seeing that are sleeping in their cars, whole families that are in tents, whole families that are having their kids removed from their homes and put into care because their families are not making enough money, cannot afford the rent, and it's really creating a crisis, not only here in the Twin Cities, but across the state of Minnesota. So, you know, you talked, Wendy, is there anything that you can see Catholic Charity doing around family homelessness?
Sure. Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Moran. Thank you so much for your words, and you are exactly right. Mm-hmm. I sadly want to share that a program we run in South Minneapolis called Hope Street for Youth, in 2019, we turned away over 1,000 youth over, like, if you add up all the nights where we just didn't have enough rooms to stay in, we turned away over 1,000 youth. We do run we run one family program in the Minneapolis-St. Paul area that is able to house 42 smaller families, and we're able to join the units for larger families. That, again, is shelter. And you'll see on the handout with the numbers, you can see then, again, how much the need is there and the balance of public and private support. And there's wonderful programs that do focus on families. Catholic Charities of St. Paul and Minneapolis has historically focused on single adults.
Okay. Thank you, Chair Liebman. And saying all that, just want to say thank you all for your advocacy, for showing up, and for Representative Cantrell for carrying this bill. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And I want to ask if there's anyone else who wanted to testify on this bill. All right, not seeing anyone. Are there other questions from members? Representative Bierman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And thank you to everybody here coming up to the Capitol. I had a number of you in my office today, and we had a nice conversation. This issue is pervasive across the state, and it's affecting every single committee that all of the legislators sit on. And so I think it's a really complex issue. You know, we had a meeting last night on Ed Policy about mental health of our children in schools, and homelessness plays a role into that, and healthcare, which you've mentioned, and housing, of course, in housing finance. That's what we talk about, is this issue. We need all of these supports of housing, healthcare, and education, which to me, it seems like when we have a homeless shelter in my community, that next step of the social services, the wraparound, helping the folks get their feet back on the ground and having that stability of housing is critical. But since it's such a complex issue, and there's so many various organizations and streams of funding from the state and for this group or that group, what would you, Ms. Underwood, recommend as sort of the next essential critical steps that we as a legislature could do, other than obviously definitely this financial support, which is a clear need to start?
Small question, Ms. Underwood.
thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Bierman. I really appreciate you calling out the connectivity that is happening around the legislature and across our state agencies. I am grateful for that. We've been working really hard, chipping away at educating members and community on what is happening to the best of our ability to be able to understand it ourselves. And so to have it be a prominent issue this session in the last couple of years has been great. I will say there's a lot to your question, and what I really recognize is how we are just clinging on to the tipping point. We are clinging. And the one-time funding last year that Representative Moran mentioned in your handouts, I want to reiterate that was one time, helped save a few more people, helped a few more people get through a few more months. You may recall there was a $5 million private investment earlier this winter to help house more people temporarily, just like Commissioner Cascaden's story. And so I would say it's the commitment to recognizing the need longer term that ends in housing. All of this, we believe, starts and ends with housing. And while there's a lot of effort to build more, to recognize naturally affordable occurring, to be able to support more people at different income levels and different needs, that we also have to keep up what is the safety net, I mean, what is the base. So I guess to answer your question is we all have to do a lot at once right now to not crash over that tipping point.
Madam Chair, Ms. Underwood, thank you very much for that response. I guess I want to leave a little bit of hope here. We were talking in my office earlier in the day about the fact that here in Minnesota, we have solved the homeless crisis before. Decades ago, it was a private-public partnership, and we got the job done. So I think with the folks in this room and the multitude of charities that can help in some small way, and the market forces we're trying to unleash in housing and finance, and the members around this table who will hopefully pass this bill out today, we can work on this issue and keep our eye on the prize. Thanks for being here.
Thank you very much. Representative Grunhagen.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. Yeah, thank you, Representative Cantrell, for bringing this bill forward. Obviously, homelessness is a crisis that affects a greater number of people, and it's just very disheartening to me to see families that are in a homeless situation. Just a couple questions. You know, last year, I think we put $3 million over 2 years into emergency services in 2019. And then a one-time funding of $1.7 million. Now, I notice there's a long list of organizations, and in fact, according to my notes I have here, there's over 200 organizations in Minnesota working to create housing stability for all Minnesotans. Is there any, and I guess my question would be for Ms. Underwood, is there any coordination between those 200 organizations in terms of meeting the need, or are they all working separately, or how does that work?
Ms. Underwood.
Madam Chair, Representative Grunhagen, thank you. I want to recognize the ESP program right now is $1.7 million over the biennium, and then last year there was a one-time infusion of $3 million to be spent the first year of the biennium because of our emergency needs last year. So thank you for recognizing those numbers. I would say two things. The coordination of those different groups is right here in this room, for sure. The Coalition for the Homeless is made up of, I think, 160 different organizations. And within that, also that number of 200 different groups, it can really depend. We are unique, Catholic Charities of St. Paul and Minneapolis, in how large we are. We are the largest provider in Minneapolis-St. Paul. But we are providing the exact same thing as what is happening around the state in Bemidji or in Rochester or in very small communities that need shelter. They need case managers to help a person navigate our really complex system to receive services and to lead to housing. So, and then there are a lot of advocates too supporting these issues. So, across our great, beautiful state, our 87 counties, there are all shapes and sizes of groups serving where they can with what they have.
Representative Gruenhagen.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. Yeah, I guess I'd like to recognize Governor Walz's effort, too. I know he raised about $5 million, according to published reports, to try to address homelessness, so he should be commended for that also. The other thing I have is, here in Minnesota, we have several different housing services and grants to administer this, and according to the Minnesota Department of Human Services here, with that $3 million last year and $1.7 million appropriated, we were able to fund six new agencies. I just don't know why, you know, DHS has over almost 7,000 employees. I don't know why we need six new agencies to administer this. And, you know, the testimony from Ms. Underwood just got saying it's complex to receive this money. To me, you know, I think we should look at consolidating some of this stuff and making it easier for the organizations that are trying to help these people access the money that they need and get as much of that money actually getting to the people that need it versus, and maybe I'm not understanding this, but creating six new agencies doesn't strike me as simplifying things. It strikes me as complicating things.
Representative Gruenhagen, maybe we could have Mr. Berg speak to that. Would that be okay?
Sure.
All right, Mr. Berg.
Madam Chair, Representative Gruenhagen, when it makes reference to six new agencies here, they're talking about homeless services agencies. That is not state government agencies. Those are six new entities which are providing homeless services, like Catholic charities.
Representative Gruenhagen.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. Thanks for that comment, Mr. Berg. So, Mr. Berg, from your perspective, could we simplify this process a little bit more so that these organizations can actually get the money they need quicker and more efficiently to meet the needs of the people who actually need it? Or are we operating in government as efficiently as possible here?
So, Representative Gruenhagen, I don't know if that's really a question. You're asking Mr. Berg to kind of do our work for us.
Seems to know a lot.
Well, he does. He does. And his credibility depends on his staying out of the fray sometimes.
Okay.
But what I would say is I think it's a very good question.
Thank you.
And I think it's something that we should definitely think about. And I would actually think that DHS might be more appropriate to ask, maybe not now, but I think it's a very good question about whether we are delivering the services as efficiently as we might. But I do want to point out, this is not government mostly. I mean, we're making grants to private organizations, nonprofits, but private organizations who are determining how to do this. And,
Medicare, they have to fill out forms to apply for that money, right?
Well, I assume they do, Representative Gruenhagen, and you know what? We wouldn't want it any other way, because when we hand out money to entities, right, we certainly want to make sure that we understand where the money's going and that it's going to be well used, and we try to, I mean, on this committee, we're constantly trying to find the right balance of that, right? How do we make sure money goes where we want it to go and nowhere else, and how do we also not stop it from going to do the things we want it to do? So, I think there's a lot to unpack here, and I appreciate your raising that issue, and the bill is going to be laid over today. There's certainly more time to talk about that, and I think maybe Ms. Underwood would even maybe meet with you to talk about it, and thank you for bringing that up. Are there other questions from members? All right, seeing none, the bill will be laid over. Let's see, we are talking about House File 1805. Now, Representative Cantrell, did you want to say anything?
Very briefly, Madam Chair, I do appreciate you taking the time to hear this bill in our committee. I know that means a lot to myself and to all the advocates who are here today and to all the advocates who weren't able to be here today because they're struggling in real time with the issues of unshelteredness. So I just wanted to thank you again, Madam Chair, for hearing this in your committee. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Representative Cantrell. So the bill will, House File 1805, will be laid over for possible inclusion in the supplemental budget bill. And now we're going to take up House File 3570, which is Representative Morrison, and is about medical assistance coverage for home health services for people who are homeless.
I'm just pointing something out to you.
To the audience, please. Folks, we're still in the hearing, so please leave quietly if you want to leave. Some of you might want to stay and hear this bill. We took this up next thinking some of it might interest some of you as well. So you're certainly welcome to stay, but if you are going to leave, please leave quietly. Welcome to the committee, Representative Morrison. And so the chair will move House File 3570 to be laid over for possible inclusion in the supplemental budget bill. So please go ahead and present your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair and members, I'm pleased to present House File 3570, a bill that would direct DHS to work with stakeholders to develop a health home model that would provide effective and much more cost-efficient care for our state's homeless population. Consider the last time you yourself or a loved one were hospitalized or underwent surgery. You recovered enough that you no longer needed to stay in the hospital, so you went home to rest and continue recovering. Maybe your spouse or other family members brought you soup, tended to your incision, made sure you had your medications, got you to your follow-up appointments, and you didn't move around much more than the doctor ordered. Now imagine you didn't even have a home to return to after being in the hospital. You're well enough to be discharged from the hospital, but certainly unwell enough that staying on the streets or in an overnight shelter will make continuing to recover a challenge, if not impossible. Without proper nutrition or being able to rest, without a safe place to store your medications or wound care supplies, having to move around in the community with everything you own during the day, taking care of yourself is incredibly difficult. And that's where recuperative care centers come into play and can make a real difference. This year, I toured a shelter in downtown Minneapolis where Hennepin Healthcare for the Homeless is providing care to patients experiencing homelessness. The Hennepin County Healthcare for the Homeless program works to decrease barriers to accessing healthcare by bringing critical services to the homeless population by locating clinics within emergency shelter and other services. This particular bill only deals with what is known as medical respite or medical recuperative care services for patients who no longer qualify for hospital level of care but can't go back out on the streets after a surgery or other adverse health event. It doesn't address the shelter or housing portion of care. A health home model under the Affordable Care Act integrates physical and behavioral health and other services and supports for higher need, higher cost Medicaid populations. By better coordinating care and linking people to needed services, health homes are designed to improve healthcare quality and reduce costs. This health home model will ensure that patients have the services they need while having a place to stay off the streets to properly recover, improve health outcomes, and prevent avoidable returns to the emergency room or readmission to a hospital. And I have Dr. Danielle Robert Shaw, who's the medical director of Hennepin Healthcare for the Homeless here, to testify, and I believe DHS is here to answer technical questions as well.
Wonderful. Thank you so much, Representative Morrison.
Thank you very much. Welcome, and please introduce yourself and state your name. Is it Dr. Robert Shaw?
Yes. My name is Danielle Robert Shaw. Last name's all one word.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Morrison, Madam Chair, and members of the committee. I want to thank you very much for allowing me the opportunity to be here today and to testify on behalf of this bill, but also many of the people who are in the room today. It's special day having homeless persons fill in the day. So as mentioned, my name is Danielle Robert Shaw. I am jointly employed between Hennepin Healthcare and Hennepin County Public Health and Healthcare for the Homeless. I serve as the medical director for the shelter-based services in Minneapolis, and I also serve as a physician who takes direct care of patients in the clinics and the shelters as well as within the hospital system. I've done this for almost 20 years, and I would say my experience doing this really relates directly back to literature that's been around for decades. My homeless patients are more likely than their housed counterparts to be sicker and at younger ages, to present to acute care services like the emergency department with potentially avoidable complications of chronic diseases, and often die much younger. The average age of death for a chronically homeless adult is 47, despite a life expectancy in the U.S. of 80 years old. Homeless shelters are ill-equipped to deal with the medical complexity that walks through their doors. Hospitals are often overwhelmed trying to find safe and comfortable places for people to discharge when they're ready to leave. And patients are rarely in a place when they're medically ill and homeless to actually prioritize getting to doctor's appointments and taking care of wounds against the struggles of daily survival. Recuperative care, or respite care as it's often known in the community, has been around for over 30 years in the U.S. It's a very well-developed model, and I personally like to think of it as a win-win-win. It eases the burden on the shelters, it closes gaps for health systems, and certainly is a better place and set of services for patients trying to recover. Basics of a program include 24/7 access to a bed, 3 meals a day, and support services where someone can stay for a short period of time to get well. Years of data tell us that when you have time to get adequate sleep, good nutrition, feel safe, put your feet up, you're more likely to recover. And as Representative Morrison mentioned, many of us, and I'm one of those fortunate people who, if I were hospitalized, would not have to think twice about those pieces of my discharge plan. I have a safe, warm home, I have a bed of my own, and I have a supportive family that would help me recover. For many in our community, and a lot of people represented here today, they're not able to think about those things. Recuperative care provides that safe space and allows someone to be able to access critical services, like connecting with ambulatory medical services, health benefits, mental health, substance use treatment, and housing navigation. Recuperative care can decrease seemingly insurmountable pressures for a number of systems. And as a doctor, I am so excited for the idea of my patients getting the right level of care, feeling well, and becoming healthier. As a health system administrator, I'm also excited to think about the opportunity of connecting people to more appropriate and lower cost services and decreasing burdens on systems like 911, EMS, EDs, and inpatients. These are all benefits that have been shown multiple times to come from recuperative care. I encounter patients every day that would be better served by recuperative care than a revolving door of acute care services which are fragmented while trying to survive on streets or in shelters. I unfortunately encounter a lot of patients, but there's one that always comes to mind when people ask about, to give an example. I was working in Harbor Light Shelter Clinic one day, and a new patient presented. His name was John. This was his first time. He came in complaining of mild cold symptoms and requesting ibuprofen for pain. I was relieved, a seemingly simple request. We started talking, and when I asked about where his pain was coming from, his story was anything but simple. He was in his early 40s and had been diagnosed with terminal cancer 8 months prior that had spread to his lung and bones. He was divorced, had 2 young children that lived with their mother in a neighboring state, and although he had been homeless for several years, despite having a steady but low-paying job, he had been unable to work the last few months because of the pain from the cancer and the side effects of his palliative chemotherapy, which made him feel like he constantly had the flu, nausea, weak, aches, and fevers. He was receiving his care at an outside system, and he's told me that the social worker at his cancer doctor's office was working on getting him a bed in a charity facility that provided hospice services, but there was quite a wait. So he was continuing to sleep in an overnight shelter where he had to leave every morning with all of his belongings, spending his days at the library trying to rest, rarely having energy to access food programs around the city or to make it to many of his doctor's appointments. He would become dehydrated and overwhelmed enough by his pain and the side effects from his chemotherapy that he would call 911 and go to the emergency department. In the last few weeks, he had been admitted to the hospital 2 of those 3 times that he'd gone to the ED. He and his doctor were at the point they were talking about stopping the chemo. He was realistic. The side effects were impeding what he had left of his life. He had 2 goals in life. He wanted to get off the chemo and hopefully rest and recuperate enough to feel well to travel briefly to see his children, who he hadn't seen in over a year. And he hoped his name came up at the top of the hospice facilities list so he didn't die on the street. I often reflect back and continue to be struck many years later by this man, where systems had failed him, who was younger than I was at the time, who was making such tough end-of-life goals and decisions. His goals were not extravagant and should not have seemed so basic and yet fraught with uncertainty. I think about what it might have been like for him to be able to offer him a recuperative care stay as a bridge to hospice, but all I could offer him was the ibuprofen he requested and allow him a safe place to tell his story. There's an unfortunate number of stories that I could share in support of this and the need for adequate, accessible, and sustainable recuperative care programs that would better serve Minnesotans who are ill and experiencing homelessness. I appreciate the many partners, including individuals and stakeholder groups, who've contributed to this work and provided the opportunity to bring the bill forward. I hope you will support the use of health homes to create a Medicaid benefit that would allow a sustainable funding source for the currently not reimbursable but vital care coordination wraparound services that are foundational for a successful recuperative care program. And thank you for the opportunity to speak and advocate on behalf of those that I care for.
Thank you very much, Dr. Robert Shaw. We have a little housekeeping to do because I understand there's an amendment in the packet here. And Representative Morrison, I assume that's your amendment, the A1? And yes. And just while she's doing that, there's also a fiscal note that's been handed out. And so is that your amendment?
Yes.
Ms. Morrison?
Okay. Sorry, Madam Chair.
So the chair will move the A1 amendment to put the bill in the order in which the author would like to have it. And it looks kind of technical. Did you want to say anything about it, Representative Morrison?
Madam Chair, it's just a technical amendment.
Okay. Ms. Sunderman's shaking her head yes, too. So the chair moves the A1 amendment. All those, is there any discussion of the A1? Seeing none, all those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. The motion prevails. So we got that done. And then, is there anyone else in the room who wants to testify on House File 3570? All right, seeing none, are there any other questions from members? Representative Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I was hidden behind there. Just more of a comment. I appreciate you bringing the bill forward. I think this is a really great model and something that we could look at. I could see this could benefit in different places throughout the state as we do more of this really innovative work. And it really does strike me, being here today on the Coalition for the Homeless Day, I worked at a homeless shelter in Duluth for a number of years, and I just got to step out and meet with some of those folks, and it's a really powerful day. And I just remember some of the sad stories, like just hearing the testifier of like being discharged to homelessness is no place to go, especially with a chronic condition, and having worked in that setting and been a part of people's lives if they walk that walk. I'm just really glad to see innovative proposals like this coming forward. Thank you.
Thank you.
Hey, thank you. Representative Bierman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted to say that one thing I've learned on the Health and Human Services Committee is that if people are treated for their conditions, they often get better, especially when they can recuperate afterwards. If they're not treated, the conditions get worse and the price goes up, and we all pay higher health care for that. So this is a great bill. Thank you, Rep. Morrison, for bringing it forward. I did have one question for Ms. Robert Shaw, and that is, what is the volume of patients that you're seeing right now, and where do those patients go for their current treatment?
Dr. Robert Shaw.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Bierman. So I spend part of my time at Hennepin Healthcare, formerly known as HCMC, and it is a little difficult in a large health system, interestingly, to determine housing status. We've done a lot of work in the last few years in trying to come up with a way to identify at a population level a risk for homelessness. So our estimates right now are about 10% of our adults who are discharged from the hospital at any given time during the year are experiencing homelessness, and so that's about 1,500 discharges per year. We have current small snippets of respite-like programs. It's very hard to find 24/7 shelter beds, and we've been able to partner with one of our local shelters who has a few of those beds, where we also have a clinic to provide kind of recuperative care light services. We have referrals 2 to 3 times for the limited number of beds per day coming out from the hospital, our hospital alone. We estimated last year that there was 400 people, and I'm looking over here, we have our nurse homeless consult, another kind of interesting role who came along, who works at the hospital, bridging between the shelter and the hospital system, that less than half the patients who really needed a 24/7 hour bed received one, much less the services. So it's hard to estimate, so I'm giving you a lot of statistics, but certainly the need is there.
Madam Chair, and just to follow up, so you have an identified site, so if this comes to fruition, where you have the locations for them?
Well,
not in the hospital.
Correct.
Dr. Robert Shaw, yeah.
Yes, thank you very much for your question, Representative Bierman. You know, the one reason we pursued this as a state benefit is because the need isn't solely in the Twin Cities. We're very fortunate at Hennepin County Medical Center to partner very closely with a number of organizations, and we do have a site identified to not only expand services, but have them in a place where it's more of a recuperative environment. I know Representative Morrison was able to come to our current site, and I might kindly say it's not a very recuperative environment. So we do have partners, Catholic Charities, who was just here, who is working with us to provide the beds and facilities. And
All right, thank you very much.
All right, thank you. So we've got Representative Moran, Representative Keel, and then I think we're going to go on to the next bill. Representative Moran.
All right, thank you, Chair Liebling. Thank you for bringing the bill forward and for the testifier. I know Catholic Charity also has a program where they have this connection and relationship with the hospitals to have a place for a patient to come out and rest and recuperate. But I was just wondering how, and forgive me if you already said this, but how do you connect with your clients? How is that connection made? Are you urban, rural, kind of like the process?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Dr. Robertson.
Thank you so much. I appreciate the question, Representative Moran. So I've worked at a number of recuperative care programs across the United States, and I would say there's around 80 programs right now. You've seen one. Here locally, the way we've been able to do it is by putting in place from the hospital side our nurse homeless consult. So she is actually healthcare for the homeless employee who's embedded on the inpatient side of the hospital. So our discharge coordinators can refer directly to her, and she's sort of our keeper of who most critically needs a bed and what beds are available with the shelter system. I would also say the healthcare for the homeless clinics also often refer people, so not only using this as a discharge, but potential prevention of hospitalization. So again, someone who could go home with some extra medications and recuperate and not need hospitalization. So we're also trying to figure out ways to maximize the beds we have to avoid hospitalization. Each program is a little different. I believe Catholic Charities has particular people in St. Paul at each of the health systems who refers directly to a nurse coordinator at the program. So a lot of different ways. I think it just depends on what your local partnerships look like.
Thank you. All right, thank you. Representative Keel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This sounds like a great program. I mean, I'd hate to see anybody not have that supervision when they need that check. Just for the benefit of your knowledge, I live in a very rural area of Minnesota. So I'm just wondering, are there any other care systems providers that are currently ready to take on, you know, whether it's a nursing home that has some respite or... I'm just wondering, what else can we do that might exist already?
And I'm not sure. I apologize. Thank you so much for the question. One of the bigger health systems that's recently reached out to us to try to get some expertise is Essentia, and my understanding is that they have quite a presence in greater Minnesota. I know there are respite programs in other parts of the United States that are in rural areas, and again, it's sort of a partnership depending who's available. If you have homeless services and health systems, I think given the benefit to both, there's creative ways to partner.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you very much for your presentation. We appreciate you. Thank you for bringing the bill, Representative Morrison. And House File 3570 is laid over for possible inclusion in the supplemental budget bill. Thank you so much.
Madam Chair.
We are next going to take up Representative we're going to take up Representative Acomb's bill, House File 3318. And just to say, we have about a half hour left in the hearing, and we do have several other matters. So if we can be concise, it would really be great. So Representative Acomb is going to move House File 3318 to be laid over for possible inclusion in the supplemental budget bill.
Yes.
So that's great. And Representative Acomb, welcome to the committee, which you're on, and go ahead and present your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. I'm before you today to talk about House File 3318. It's a bill that modifies the housing support program known as Metro Demo by modifying an existing exemption to the moratorium on the development of new housing support beds. Metro Demo is a project created in 1995 in the housing support division, formerly known as GRH. This expansion would create the resources immediately to provide needed housing connected to services for single adults and families. This bill is a partnership and combination of Beacon Interfaith Housing Collaborative, Dakota County, and Minnesota Intercounty Association. Both were coming forward with similar proposals to increase the Metro Demo, and with the approved, well, actually, we did that in last last committee, so never mind that part. What the bill does, it increases the Metro demo from 226 units to 650 units. It increases Metro demo to encompass the entire seven Metro county or Metro area, in adding Scott, Carver, and Washington counties. It directs 146 of the units to be for supportive housing for families in Scott and Hennepin counties. And it updates the language to reflect the current uses of the program. And so I'm joined today by Madeline Kassler with Dakota County and also Lee Blons, who is the CEO and president of Beacon Interfaith Housing Collaborative. They'll be brief and tell you a little bit more.
All right. Thank you very much. Welcome to the committee. If you could just please introduce yourself and go ahead.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Madeline Kassler. I'm with Dakota County Social Services. I'm in partnership with the Seven County Metro Area, the Minnesota Intercounty Association, or MICA, and Beacon. Dakota County has proposed an expansion of the Metro Demo Project to more immediately and effectively provide housing for people experiencing homelessness. As you know, there is a focused effort to end homelessness at all levels of government right now. While the problem seems daunting, the solutions are straightforward. People need a place to live, a way to pay for that place, and support services. And right now, all of those resources are scarce. The proposed expansion of Metro Demo is a unique way to quickly expand access to rental assistance and support services. The demo project mimics traditional rental assistance, with a person paying 30% of their income toward rent. Those who qualify can transition onto housing choice vouchers or other traditional rental assistance resources when those become available while retaining their support services. When someone transitions onto another resource, that vacated demo spot can then be recycled to a new person. The Metro counties will jointly manage these resources and will engage in analysis and community engagement to funnel them to places where our system is currently stuck. In a recent analysis, the metro area counties identified 848 households, both families and single adults, who were unhoused and qualified for Metro Demo. We recognize that this is a significant undercount of actual need and also recognize that we're not trying to solve for the whole of homelessness through this proposal. Metro Demo is one piece of the puzzle, and the request to increase demo spots by 424 reflects this balance. Additionally, we are proposing to strike language that prescribes that 70% of the population served must be exiting a treatment facility or hospital. By doing this, the demo resource would continue to target a vulnerable population, those who are experiencing homelessness and living with a mental illness, history of substance abuse, or HIV, while also maintaining flexibility to serve people who are currently falling through the cracks in our system. As other resources grow or shrink, and as the housing market changes, it's important to have a resource that can flex to fill gaps and meet needs more immediately. The remainder of the strikeout language provides alignment with the broader housing support program and cleans up some obsolete language. Thank you very much for your time and for your consideration, and I'll pass it on to Lee Pons from Beacon.
All right, thank you for your testimony. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Madam Chair and members of the committee, I'm Lee Blons, the CEO of Beacon Interfaith Housing Collaborative. We're a collaborative of over 100 congregations in the metro area that provide emergency shelter, develop and operate deeply affordable and supportive housing, and advocate for public policy toward the goal that all people have a home. Beacon provides over 600 homes in 18 apartment buildings. Almost all of them are affordable for people making less than $25,000 a year. We're a leader in supportive housing with services integrated right in our apartment buildings to help those with mental illness, chemical dependency, or other barriers successfully transition from homelessness to a stable home. As an organization that provides emergency shelter for families, we're grateful to be part of this hearing today to highlight the need to shelter people tonight and the need to invest in long-term solutions. When my son was in kindergarten, he invited his girlfriend to his birthday party, and she said, "I can't come, I'm in a shelter." And my son, knowing what I do, said, "Don't worry, my mom will build you a home." Aww. Now, I can't do that, but I do believe that we can. Unfortunately, my son is now 20 years old, and we still have too many families that don't have a home. Families that were displaced on Christmas morning out onto the streets and still months later can't find a home they can afford.
So I'm here to ask you for your support to expand the Metro Demo housing support program so that Beacon can create homes for families that have the most difficult time finding and retaining deeply affordable housing. We have sites to develop 146 new homes in Shakopee, North Minneapolis, and Hopkins. But our greatest barrier is the operating and service funding. The Metro Demo Housing Support Program works well for families because the program is sized to fit the size of apartments, including 2- and 3-bedroom homes. This new family supportive housing would focus on families that have experienced long-term homelessness. This instability is usually connected to an underlying mental health or chemical dependency. By providing mental health and other supportive services right in the apartment building, families are stabilized, and it can prevent the removal of children by the child welfare system. I imagine the day when that little girl in kindergarten, instead of missing a birthday party, can say, "I'm having a birthday party in my home. Can you come?" Thank you.
Thank you very much. We appreciate that very much. I just want to say to members, this bill will carry a fiscal note, but we don't have one. It's going to be laid over today for possible inclusion. We will definitely bring this back, and certainly if it is going to be included in the supplemental budget, we will bring it back and discuss it, a fiscal note, when we have it. But I just learned from Mr. Berg that it wasn't prepared in time, so it's on its way to us. Are there any other testifiers, anyone who'd like to testify for or against the bill? All right, I'm not seeing any. And member questions. Representative Calverson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And just very, very briefly, I just wanted to say, as a Dakota County legislator and seeing the work that Ms. Kassler has done in Dakota County, and conversations I had this morning with Dakota County residents about homelessness in our county, I think that this bill is an example of us being able to ensure that homelessness is not a permanent family situation or a permanent individual situation. It is a blip in people's lives, and this really puts all the pieces together to provide some flexibility for people so that they can make homelessness a memory.
Thank you. Representative Haley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And just a question about your DE amendment. I met with some of our county folks this morning, and we were talking about the challenge when clients are discharged from a regional treatment center and, again, may have mental health issues and discharge to the county, and we have lack of resources to provide housing for them. But in your DE, that the language is deleted that would allow those individuals to participate. Can you just clarify, or maybe I'm misunderstanding the language?
Okay, and Representative Haley, we're kind of looking at each other here because what DE you're talking about, did you just mean the bill, the language as it is right now?
My staff has just clarified that that was changed in policy committee.
So, well, let's let Representative Akam can respond. Actually, maybe, or one of the testifiers can respond to that.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, the strikeout language that I believe you're referring to requires that 70% of persons served be exiting from a regional treatment center or hospital. We would like to strike that language in order to create flexibility to serve people who are experiencing homelessness from a variety of locations. So, for example, we've recently partnered with the state, with the Met Council, to pair housing choice vouchers that are allocated to people who are living on the trains to Metro Demo in order to bridge people into housing services and then transition quickly onto the housing choice voucher. If we have that 70% language in statute, we're locked into a very specific population rather than being able to be nimble to address needs where they pop up. Another example I'll provide is for the regular housing support program, so not Demo. We have a small pilot in which we're working with people who are cycling in and out of institutions to directly target housing support resources to that specific population, because we noticed through our data analysis with our Metro Counties group that those folks were not being served elsewhere, and they were continuing to cycle in and out of institutions and into our homelessness system. So with that flexibility, we can look at our data, see where the needs are, and funnel those resources appropriately.
And then, Madam Chair.
Thank you for that clarification.
And Madam Chair, if you may, and just it wouldn't preempt those people being discharged from being considered, and so just recognizing that.
Right, and I have a corollary question to that as I look at the language that's being struck. So under current law, somebody has to keep track of the 70%, right? So how do you even do that? When somebody comes in, you say, okay, which box do we check off? And then you got to keep track and figure out that that's only 70% or that there is 70. So how do you do that? Is it even really feasible right now? Ms. Kassler?
Yeah, Madam Chair, members of the committee, it is the more boxes that we have to check, the more complicated it becomes to track that and make sure that we're complying with state law. That said, if the language remains, we would be compliant with state law and we would figure out how to track that appropriately. The metro counties are just starting to manage the demo project, the current demo beds, the 226 jointly, through a cooperative agreement that we have that we just updated in 2017. So the metro counties together will be jointly managing this project, whether it remains at 226 or we get to 650 through this process. And we will be tracking the statute requirements.
Okay, thank you very much. Seeing no other questions, Representative Acomb, did you want to have any closing comment?
No, I appreciate you giving us the opportunity to be here today, and I don't know if this is being laid over or if we need to bring it back with the fiscal note, so well, procedurally, whatever that
is. Right, so the bill's going to be laid over. It means it stays in our committee until, yeah. If it gets included in a supplemental budget. So with that, House File 3318 is laid over for possible inclusion in the supplemental budget.
Thank
you very
Chair.
Much. Okay, we're going to go then to Representative Edelson, and we're going to first take up House File 2898, which is the civil commitment bill. The chair will move House File 2898 and to be sent to the General Register.
Yes, Madam Chair, and I have two amendments as well.
All right, so let's see. Which one, does it matter which order they're in?
No, it doesn't. The A20, I can explain when you're ready.
Okay, so the chair will move the 820. Oh, I see. Okay. Yes, the chair will move the A200703 amendment. And Representative Adelson, do you want to just tell us what that does?
Yes, Madam Chair. The A20 is the DHS, the Department of Human Services provision that would ensure the department can ensure that the patients get timely access to the services they need. Sometimes patients will sit in jails or in facilities waiting for access. And so this was an agreed upon language that the Civil Commitment Working Group agreed to, as well as this went through judiciary yesterday.
Okay, so any discussion of the amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. The motion prevails. And then to the A4 amendment, Representative Adelson, do you want to just, the chair will move the A4 amendment. And is there, do we need to discuss, or is this mostly?
This, Madam Chair, is an agreement between the APRN group to make sure that APRNs are able to work to help persons that are being civilly committed. And so this was agreement with the working group, the Civil Commitment Working Group, and APRNs.
Okay. Is there any questions or discussion to the amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. the motion prevails. So, members, as you can see, this is a pretty extensive bill. It's been through a number of committees already, I think, and had a pretty good hearing. I know there was a hearing in Judiciary on this that I'm on, and also in Health Policy on this bill. So I don't want us to go through the whole bill again, because this is the Fiscal Committee, but do you want to just present it very briefly, and then mainly we have the fiscal note here, and maybe we can just have Mr. Berg speak to the fiscal note, but why don't I just let you just very briefly describe the bill for us, for those who haven't heard it yet, Representative Adelson, or Ms. Abderholden, if you prefer.
Madam Chair, this bill, by the way, has gone to HHS Policy, Judiciary, and Public Safety. It does not have a fiscal note, so hopefully, Mr. Berg, that comes true to you too as well. But this is a result of a working group that came together: DHS staff, attorneys, counties, NAMI. Ms. Abderholden had led that group, community provider, psychiatrist, psychologist. It does not change the current commitment standard. It doesn't make it easier or harder. This is just some clarifying language to be able to. I mean, this is a very complicated process, and so just making it sure, making it a little clearer for providers and all persons involved with the civil commitment process to be able to provide better care to persons involved.
Okay, and then thank you for that. And Mr. Berg, do you want to, even though we say it has no fiscal note, there actually is one. It's just zero. So I'm going to, Mr. Berg.
Madam Chair, members, that pretty much encompasses what there is to say. There's a fiscal note on this bill. It has no cost. All the agencies have reported it's completed. There's no cost.
Okay, great. That's great. And I just to say to members and to the public, sometimes these fiscal notes are really interesting to read too, because it's just another way of understanding the bill. There's some narrative in here that kind of talks about what assumptions they're making and how they see the bill working and things like that. So certainly might be worth looking at as well. And I think that Mr. McQuillan went to just, I think, check on the path of the bill. Are we, Representative Adelson, are we, you're expecting
the general register.
The general register? Mm-hmm. Okay. You know what, I'm just going to wait a moment for him to get back, because I don't know why there's a question or if there's a question about this, but I just want to be sure before we actually vote the bill out. So just hold on a second. We have a question from Representative Munson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Happy to be a filler. question for the bill author. Because the fiscal note doesn't show an impact, does that mean that there will not be, that there is assumed to not be an increase in civil commitments under the language changes of this bill?
Maybe that's a good question for Mr. Berg. Mr. Berg, you can be a filler too.
Madam Chair, Representative Munson. Yeah, that's the assumption, and I think Ms. Abderholden can, we've had discussion that it updates language in a variety of ways, but it makes an assumption that the same people will end up being committed to the care of the commissioner as would have otherwise been.
And Madam Chair,
Abderholden, if you could just first state your name for the record.
Yes, Sue Abderholden, Executive Director of NAMI Minnesota. We actually hope that it will go down, because we have a voluntary engagement section in there so that we can engage with people voluntarily before they ever, you know, before they get that sick, that they meet the commitment criteria. So we're which is a permissive section of the bill. So if counties decide to do that, we could possibly actually reduce the number of commitments, which would actually be a good thing.
All right. Thank you. And so we are sure that it is going to the general register. We just had, you know, because we changed our policies from last year, we just weren't, some bills fall in different buckets. It's just a technical issue. But anyway, we have another question, Representative Keel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Actually, not a question, but I just wanted to support this bill. I know that NAMI, along with a lot of other, a large amount of groups, have worked on this. I was privileged to participate mostly on the phone, thank goodness, not driving back and forth, because there were a ton of meetings. But I really appreciate the effort that went into reviewing and updating the language on civil commitment. Hopefully this will help people to get the help they need quicker and help our counties to be able to function, to be able to help the citizens that need that assistance. So thank you.
Thank you, Representative Keel. Thanks for saying that. I echo that. You know, a lot of work has been done by Representative Adelson, by Ms. Abderholden, and a lot of other people to get to where we are with this. And thank you very much for all that effort. So with that, the chair renews the motion that House File 2898, as amended, be re-referred to the General Register. All in favor of the motion, please say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. The motion prevails. Thank you very much. And we have Representative Adelson's House File 1914. And this one is going to Ways and Means. So the chair will move that House File 1914 be re-referred, recommended for re-referral to Ways and Means. And there is an A5 amendment, and is that your amendment, Representative Adelson?
Yes, Madam Chair, and then also I believe there is an A6. Mrs. Plumquist, she possibly has.
We don't have an A6. Yes, we do. It just has to be handed out. So, Representative Adelson, maybe do you need the A? Do you want to put on the A5 and then discuss it with the A5 on it?
Madam Chair, the A5 is an amendment that updates statutes being amended in the bill, sections that are no longer necessary. Also, it looks at a Minnesota rule. It was a compromise with the prosthetics and orthotics to be prescribed by a physician, and this was the APRNs and the group that they had worked it this out as an agreement, and it looks like everybody's in agreement with that. And then the A6, if you want me to talk about that one.
Okay, well, let's do it one step at a time. Okay. So the A5 is that you just described. Just so I'm clear, the A5 is the one that represents the agreement that you were discussing? I'm just wondering, first of all, which one we should adopt first.
The A5 makes sense to adopt first, Madam Chair.
Okay, and that is the one that the agreement is reflected in the other amendment. This is just...
Well, they're both actually agreements with... Okay. So this one, the A5, covers three different areas, and it's about just updating statutes is one. Actually, it looks like that's one issue. The second is this was working with DHS to delete a few things that DHS wanted to delete, which were no longer necessary. And then the third is that it was an agreement between the prosthetics and orthotics with the APRNs.
All right. Are there any questions to the A5? All right. So the chair is moving the A5 amendment. Seeing no questions, all those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. Motion prevails. So we adopted that one. And then the chair will move the A6 amendment, and that one is also reflects the agreement, and then the author can discuss it with all this in place. Okay, so seeing no questions to that one, the chair will move the A6. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. Motion prevails. Thank you. So, okay. We have only like 5 minutes, and actually we have another bill. So,
okay,
Representative Adelson, this is a large bill, but
I can sum it up pretty fast.
Okay, and this is the Finance Committee, and I understand that this bill has no cost. Again. Is that right?
That's right, Madam Chair.
Okay, so just give us a summary of where we're at with the bill, if you would.
Madam Chair, this is the APRN bill. It's really a housekeeping bill. It looks at outdated statutes. It updates them. it looks at how some of the stuff that it's updating allows an APRN to complete necessary paperwork. So this is about patient safety and patient care. So this has been years and years in the making. Since 2018, the group has been working on this. People that they've checked with, Minnesota Medical Association's okayed this, Minnesota Board of Medicine, the Minnesota Board of Nursing, DHS, Department of Health, Board of Pharmacy. So it's really a consensus bill to make sure that patients in Minnesota are getting the best care we can get for them.
Okay. Representative Monson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Adelson, I know this is a really long bill and there's a lot of provisions in here. I've been meeting with some people kind of for or against this bill. And overall, I like the idea of people practicing to the top of their license just from, you know, from simple care. I just want to go in and see a nurse practitioner so it would be less expensive, and I hope we can keep our healthcare costs down. But since a lot of the advanced practice registered nurse, as you call them, are going to be kind of following the protocols and the electronic health records, some of the studies show that this practice actually causes more testing to be done because they're kind of following a process, as opposed to physicians that would use their medical knowledge to deter, you know, to maybe not go down certain paths. Is it a concern that this would also increase the costs for healthcare? I mean, we're using cheaper practitioners, but in the end, it could cost more money with the extra tests ordered. And maybe if you have a testifier that could answer that, would be helpful too.
So, Representative Munson, I would love us to spend a lot of time on this bill because there certainly is a lot here. Could you tell us where has this bill been, Representative Adelson? I know it went to policy.
Madam Chair, it went to policy and then here.
And that's the only place. Okay. Well, go ahead and ask the question. We're going to run out of time here, and we really don't have time to go into all the policy implications of the bill, although I'm with you on the underlying question. I really am, but I'm just trying to move this through. But if you could introduce yourself, please, and answer briefly.
Sure. I'm Brian Goodroad. I'm the president of the Minnesota APRN Coalition. And there is conflicting data on the use of tests in different situations. There's data that shows that actually a number of practices of APRN actually utilize less laboratory testing and diagnostic criteria. It is a bit inaccurate to say we simply follow a protocol because APRNs are educated at the level of master's or doctoral, and we actually use decision-making and clinical decision-making and critical thinking as well to determine what's the best process. We do utilize the best evidence-based practice guidelines that are there to guide our care, and I would say we're quite good at doing that. So I would actually answer that I don't think there's absolute evidence that the APRN use increases the amount of testing. We can look at data and studies that show conflicting data on that as well.
Okay. And Madam Chair, just a quick question to follow.
Representative Munson.
So some other states require that nurse practitioners and doctors of nursing practice disclose to the patient that they're not a physician. Because it can be really confusing, especially if you have doctor, on a name tag or something. Would you be supportive of this requirement for Minnesota for disclosing? Or
And I'm sorry to say your name again.
Brian Goodroad.
Mr. Goodroad.
Yeah.
Okay, please.
Minnesota statute already says that we have to be clear about our role. Our name tags have to be clear about that we're a nurse practitioner. I have a doctorate degree, but my name tag says nurse practitioner. So we absolutely already have statute that we have to be clear about our role and not be misgiving in that we are in a physician role.
Okay.
All right. Thank you, Representative Munson. Are there other questions from members? And this bill is going back to Ways and Means, right? So, all right. Is there anyone else in the audience? Oh, I'm sorry. And there's another testifier, and I didn't give you an opportunity. Okay, you're okay.
Madam Chair, they're just here to answer questions.
Okay, great. And is there anyone in the audience who wanted to testify for or against the bill? All right, seeing none. Other questions from members? All right, not seeing any. So the chair will renew the motion that House File 1914, as amended, be re-referred to the Committee on Ways and Means. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. the motion prevails. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Member.
So everybody knows we have one more bill on the agenda, which is House File 3980, which is, again, the bill we've been, this is kind of our everyday bill, our daily bill. We're keeping it on the agenda. And I really apologize to people who are here to testify on that today. We are going to have to kick it over to tomorrow's agenda. I don't think that's a terrible thing because we are trying to continue to gather more information. We very much want to hear testimony from people in the health provider community about what their potential needs are with the COVID-19 issue. And but as well, I think there is some urgency to the bill, which is why we're keeping it on like we are and trying to deal with this. And but we also recognize that we're probably talking about a lot of dollars, and so we also do want to do our due diligence and make sure we hear testimony on what the needs are and so on. So I really am sorry that we're not going to get to that today, but it will be on the agenda for tomorrow. And I know there are some amendments. And members, if you I want to say to members again, I'm very open to hearing what members want to do with the fund and how you see it and whether you think there are issues that need to be dealt with. And please let me know. I mean, it's, you know, I'm happy to talk to anybody about that. I really welcome your input. I've had at least one member say that they've got input, but I haven't received it yet. But we are trying to move this somewhat urgently, so please do. You don't have to have an amendment. Just write me a note and say, what about this or what about that? That would be just fine. So with that, we are adjourned.